You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I'm your co-host, Katie Putz, also recording in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, Katie. Good to have you back on the show.
Happy to be back.
So, Katie, I thought we would spend this episode talking about a couple recent political developments with geopolitical implications in the Asia-Pacific region. A couple of our listeners likely have wondered if we would come to these topics, and the answer is yes. We will be talking about the recent inauguration of a new president in Taiwan, William Lai, or Lai Ching-te, who gave his inaugural address on May 20th. So we'll talk a little bit about the implications there for cross-strait relations and the possibility of a more hardline policy by China towards Taiwan. And the second big political development, of course, is the outcome of the Indian election results. We previewed what was at stake in the Indian elections, and the results, I think, are rather interesting. Not necessarily as clear cut of a victory for the BJP as the BJP might have liked. So we'll talk a little bit about what that might mean for how India might approach some of its foreign policy priorities and whether there is a relation between the domestic political outcome there and Indian foreign policy. But I think the place to start maybe, Katie, is Taiwan. Do you want to kind of share with our listeners kind of your broader takeaways on Lai's inaugural speech and what we've seen since in the Taiwan Strait?
Yeah, certainly. So, Lai was inaugurated on May 20th, as you mentioned, a little over a month ago now. And it's really interesting to kind of read the analyses of his inaugural speech. In sort of Western and Taiwanese analyses, it's sort of pointed out that he's essentially continuity is the theme, continuity with the previous administration and with its position when it comes to Taiwan's place as a as an already independently acting entity in the world. And this is, I think, is a little bit different. Lai is always sort of accused of being a pro-independence sort of figurehead, but certainly moderated a lot of those tendencies in his term as vice president, and that has shown through. But when you look at sort of Chinese commentary on the speech, you know, it's characterized as having been, you know, dangerously pro-independence and therefore sort of justifying the more muscular military engagements we saw right after the inauguration. And so it's one of those things that's truly in the eye of the beholder in some ways. I'm curious what you made of the speech and maybe we can go into some of those responses from China afterward.
Yeah, so I think, you know, China, in a way, I think, has written off Lai for a long time as a potentially productive partner for better cross-strait ties. So I think we saw in the pressure campaign leading up to the Taiwanese elections and in the reaction after the election that China really didn't have any kind of interest in being conciliatory here. And, you know, Lai's history, as you sort of noted, has, I think, sort of fed into those narratives. You know, Lai in 2017, for instance, described himself as a, quote, pragmatic worker for Taiwan independence. Now, 2017 was a long time ago, and since then, of course, as he moved towards the mainstream of Taiwanese politics and harbored aspirations to formally succeed Tsai Ing-wen, who was a lot more moderate, even if China criticized her as well, you know, Lai, I think, wasn't necessarily able to persuade Beijing, certainly, that he wasn't going to be as, I guess, independence-minded as China perceives him to be. And then there's sort of, some other details, I guess. I think some people observed that Lai mentioned the concept of the Republic of China, Taiwan's formal name, a lot more than Tsai did in her last inaugural address. He broadly, though, I think, indicated an interest in, of course, maintaining peace, maintaining the status quo more broadly. No reference to the 1992 consensus, which is, of course, not surprising for anybody, I guess, tracking the DPP's evolution under Chinese pressure over the last few years. But nevertheless, one more kind of indicator for Beijing of, I guess, his disposition towards China and the notion of one China more broadly. And so those are, I think, some of the important observations here. I think China's broader approach, you know, you talked about the military exercises. China started on May 23rd a set of large-scale drills around Taiwan called Joint Sword 2024A. And I think that was very much in line with the pattern that we saw starting in August 2022 when former U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan and the Chinese carried out unprecedentedly intense exercises near Taiwan. So I think we're slowly still seeing China constrain Taiwan, limit Taiwan's room for maneuver, and broadly speaking, change the status quo in peacetime around Taiwan with additional military exercises. So that does, I think, continue to contribute to this broad sense of concern around the Taiwan Strait of a potential conflict. The Chinese statement around those exercises was interesting because it was just a few days after the inauguration, and they said it was meant to, quote, serve as a strong punishment for the separatist acts of Taiwan independence forces and a stern warning against the interference and provocation by external forces, i.e. the United States. So those are kind of some of the observations that I had. But Katie, I mean, what else do you think you know, our listeners should be kind of paying attention to here, though? Because I think obviously we are entering a new presidency, a new era where there's very little optimism for better cross-strait relations. But do you see any other dynamics at play here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, even though this is a geopolitics podcast, I don't think listeners should overlook the domestic situation in Taiwan. We don't need to get too deep into it. But the legislative reform bill package that the opposition parliament, the parliament is held by the opposition party, the KMT, and their partner, the TPP, they passed a package of bills that were characterized by the KMT and the TPP as legislative reform. Critics see some of these provisions as being potentially very problematic for the government and for Taiwanese businesses in particular. It includes sort of specific provisions that would enable the legislative yuan to summon and question witnesses regardless of who they are, in government, outside of government, whatever, which people find problematic. It triggered a serious protest movement. I think at the height in sort of late May, there's 100,000 people on the streets in Taipei. And so that's something to keep an eye on. That package did get passed. The parliament then rejected a request for a review. The president, I believe, actually signed it, but has said that he's going to seek a sort of a constitutional review. We'll see where that goes, but there's certainly something domestically there to keep an eye on. And then there are also some of the trade issues that I think are worth watching. After the inauguration, China announced that it would end preferential trade tariffs on a whole host of goods. This is something we've seen in the past, and it ebbs and flows. It actually never touches on goods that China needs in order for its own external trade, but on things that are particularly important to Taiwanese producers. The Chinese market is pretty big for Taiwan, obviously. And then I think the last thing I want to point out is a bit of news that I saw today, in which Taiwan issued a travel advisory for China. Beijing had issued new legal guidelines to punish those that it says support the island's formal independence, including in the most extreme cases, execution, which is, you know, quite a clickbait headline to put out there. But I think it is important to keep an eye on the fact that Taiwan has warned its citizens against traveling to China unless necessary. And so maybe they're sort of anticipating something. I do think the last point we should make on this is kind of back to your comment that, you know, there really, I don't think there was anything that Lai could have said or done that would have made Beijing think that it was going to have a partner across the strait. And so there does not seem to be much of an opening for a de-escalation of tensions. And so I think we're just looking at ways that things can be triggered to get worse. So hopefully they don't, but we shall see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a good place to kind of wrap this up. The last thing I did want to just mention was that what was interesting about Lai compared to Tsai in the past was that Lai directly took on the issue of Chinese military actions and gray zone coercion in the inaugural address. He called them the greatest strategic challenges to global peace and stability. And so I think this might have been largely due to a calculation that China probably would have carried out some kind of kinetic show of force. I think many in Taiwan expected something around the time of the inauguration. But I thought that was important, too, that, you know, here you have a newly inaugurated Taiwanese president directly pointing out China's attempts to apply military pressure on the island. So All right, let's change gears a little bit. We haven't really been doing a two-parter podcast in a while, but I did think it was important to also talk a bit about the outcomes of the Indian elections, which we previewed for our listeners a few episodes ago. So the upshot here is that the BJP still won. Narendra Modi is still Prime Minister of India, but the BJP, notably for the first time since 2014, has to now rule as part of a coalition. They did not secure the majority necessary in the lower house of the Indian parliament, the Lok Sabha, to basically rule without coalition partners. So in essence, this does mean that more so than ever, the BJP will have to negotiate on certain issues, largely in domestic politics, with its key coalition partners, a party from Bihar known as the Janata Dal United, and a southern Indian party known as the Telugu Desam Party, both of whom will be the key coalition players that will have some ability to limit the BJP's agenda. Now, you know, Katie, we talked a bit about, of course, how Indian elections are, like elections in most places, aren't decided by foreign policy questions. But I think there's an interesting discussion to be had about what this might mean for how India might behave externally. And, you know, my sense is, and I'd love to hear your impression, is that we will broadly see continuity here. But I think on issues like defense deals, India's engagement with major partners like the United States, even Russia to an extent, I can see some of the contestation that used to happen in Indian domestic politics now potentially actually bounding how the BJP chooses to sort of maneuver overseas, just to avoid kind of controversies in parliament where these issues might intersect with other domestic priorities. And similarly for, I think, countries trying to work with India, I think it will be interesting now where Modi isn't quite as centralized in his power. And so there might be a greater impulse to now engage the BJP's coalition partners and possibly even the opposition, right? The opposition, of course, is not necessarily an opposition in the traditional sense where they have some kind of unifying ideology. They are more a anti-BJP coalition. But nevertheless, I think that's going to be an interesting set of circumstances now in India politically that I think will spill over to foreign policy. What's your read on this?
Yeah, so I think on the election outcomes itself, you know, it is interesting, you know, to have won, to ostensibly won an election, but also all of the discussion about winning that election being essentially how the BJP lost the election. I think when you look at the numbers, it really does kind of jump out just how far the BJP slid back, but also it still is overwhelming dominant party in the Indian parliament. And, you know, I think one of the things to keep in mind with that is that even though the BJP has to rule in coalition with a number of other smaller parties, two in particular that you named, it doesn't seem like, I'm not convinced that either of them can really exert the kind of influence over the BJP that people might think or wish. One of the reasons I say that is because within that coalition, the BJP has 240 seats. The other two parties have 16 and 12, and those are the highest in the BJP's coalition, the NDA. In comparison, the India bloc, the Congress has 99 seats, and there are several other parties that have seats in the 30s and 20s. So it's a much more diverse coalition. And so I think most analysts that I've read are expecting sort of continuity within the parliament, possibly reining in some of the more right-wing impulses of the BJP, but not necessarily. Now, how that translates to foreign policy, I think you're right in that. I think we continue to see sort of continuity. India's interests remain the same, and the government's sort of position on a lot of global affairs are going to be the same. And that's frankly because even the opposition in the Indian parliament holds a lot of the same views when it comes to foreign policy issues. I remember hearing Rahul Gandhi speaking in DC last year, in which he essentially said, you know, India's position with regard to Russia would remain the same, really, regardless of if the Congress had returned to power, if BJP stayed in power. So that's just one issue. But I do think this election is a reminder that India is a large and fractious democracy, and that it does have multiple parties. And so sort of putting all of your eggs in the Modi basket is not going to last forever. You know, this election certainly showed that the BJP is not undefeatable, that Politics in India, like most other countries, ebbs and flows, power swings from one side to another. And so while the BJP certainly will be in power for the next 5 years, it's not guaranteed that it will continue past that. And so from a foreign policy perspective, sort of building bridges with all of the possible powers in India is important. I am curious, what if any changes do you think there might be to foreign policy? Because I just don't see that those being the massive issues sort of within India's political realm.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, right? I think broadly, broadly speaking, Indian foreign policy has maintained continuity. I mean, since the early 2000s, you could even argue, broader strategic convergence with the United States, growing skepticism of China, continued ambivalence about Russia, sort of cooperating with Russia where necessary. All of that, I think, will remain in place. I think an interesting question is, the BJP's postmortem on the value of a more overtly Hindu nationalist foreign policy, which is something that we had seen under the second term, which also spilled into some domestic issues, including immigration policy, which affected India's relations with its neighbors. One of the outcomes here from this election might be that actually is not a winning electoral recipe for the BJP, even if that is at the party's sort of ideological core and identity. And so we could potentially see a slight kind of, the pedal coming off the accelerator there a little bit, even if the BJP isn't going to move away whole scale, given that does play well with the party's committed base. But the other thing also is, this election in a way does give the BJP perversely this talking point that, some of the anxiety about Indian democracy backsliding perhaps might have been a little overblown, because clearly the Indian electorate was actually able to in a way show that anti-incumbency forces, which have been historically quite powerful in Indian politics, do remain functional, even if the BJP has consolidated more political power than any political party really since the years after India's immediate independence, when the Congress party was incredibly dominant. So that, I think, is also going to be interesting, particularly how we see that manifest in the U.S.-India relationship, where I think there had been a much greater discussion of India's democratic backsliding, human rights situation, so on and so forth. So that, I think, will also be a potential outcome here. But just thought it was important to kind of flag that for our listeners. Again, no kind of sharp changes, I think, in Indian foreign policy, but something that I think, this election was, I think, ultimately a fairly surprising outcome for the BJP, and I think a lot of what had been anticipated for India beforehand.
Yeah, I just want to make one final point, which is that our expectations versus the outcome is a really interesting thing, I think, to go back and look at. And why, because even exit polling and sort of as the votes were happening, mm-hmm. there's just a lot of discussion about how the BJP, it's going to get 400 seats. This coalition is going to get 400 seats. They came nowhere close to that. And so why there's this sort of difference between the expectations and the reality is an interesting question. I think part of that answer has to do with the media in India and sort of the level of discussion and really just how the BJP sort of positioned Modi as this extremely popular figure. And so therefore the BJP would do well, but Modi wasn't running in every single race. And Modi, I believe, got the second lowest victory percentage in the race he did contest. So even Modi didn't do that well in his own race. Kind of pinning all of your tails on one donkey, which is a terrible metaphor, I apologize, is not a great idea. I can't take it back, so we'll leave it out there. But I think sort of that gap between our expectations and reality and uh-huh. and the outcomes is something for people to explore and think about, and that is writ large on probably every election. But we can move on from there.
Great. Well, I think we'll leave it there for today. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot as always for joining me, Katie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am going to make one last interruption. We are just about to release the July issue of the magazine. I encourage listeners to check it out. This month, we actually look at the evolution of India's foreign policy under Narendra Modi and sort of its aspirations to great power status. We explore Japan's long-running, but I think little remarked upon engagement with the Pacific Island countries, another hot topic in geopolitics. And then we take a look at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is set to expand in July with the addition of its first strictly European country, Belarus, and what that means for what had been a Eurasian project into the future. There's a lot more in the issue. Please check it out. Let us know what you think.
Awesome. And on that note, please leave us a review if you like what you hear on the podcast, and make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you have any suggestions for future issues you'd like covered on the podcast, as always, feel free to reach out to either of us. You can do that via social media or our emails. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.